Welcome to At a Crossroads with the Naked Podcaster. I'm your host, Jen Taylor. This podcast is for those of you who know that you are built with strength and love that is meant to shine through in times of conflict and in times of celebration. Please subscribe, like, leave a review, and connect with me. All the links are in the description, and I personally respond to every comment and every contact. I cannot wait to engage with you. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome to At a Crossroads Naked Podcast. I'm here with Kate Shutt. I didn't even ask you about the pronunciation of your name.
Holy well, you God. Nailed it.
Woo! Yes. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm excited too. And your website is your name. So it's kateshutt.com.
Correct.
Wow, that, you could have fun with your name, huh? That was kind of fun to say. Jump in and let's talk about, first of all, I have all of the links in the description. People can find you, and I stalk you everywhere equally. Mm-hmm. But tell us all about what's on the website, which is a lot.
Oh, you can listen to all my music there, or yeah, most of my music, from especially from my newest album, Bright Nowhere. There's a little bit of a bio on there. It's not your traditional bio, but it's a bio. It tells you a lot about me. There's a link to my TED talk or TEDx talk that I did about grief and loss, called A Grief Casserole. There's my description of some work I do down in rural Alabama with a group of kids down there. There's also, some information about this ongoing project I do with my fans called the Mail Me One Thing Project, which is basically like a letter writing, like a pen pal exchange, but sort of like that, cooler than that. So you can find out about all that stuff on there.
Yeah, it was huge. The website, I mean, I was like, oh, and there's this. Oh, and there's this. Oh, look at this. I was surprised. You can listen to your album without purchasing it.
Sure, it's 2021.
Yeah. Yes. So I want to jump into something because I read your story about Tina Turner. Like, I was born in 1970. So when you talked about getting your wanting like the Walkman and the Tina Turner cassette, and I was like, wow, take me back for sure. Mm-hmm. Because that's my generation, you know, of
yeah.
And everybody totally wanted, I still want to be Tina Turner, or at least channel my inner Tina Turner.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
You have a book, and I want to dive in a little bit to your TED talk. I missed the pen pal thing. I didn't even.
I think it's down in maybe on the connect tab.
Okay.
I don't know. Not sure. Can't remember. People find it.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have Stories, which is your blog.
Yes.
You have events that are coming up. You have your book, and then you can find your TEDx talk. So it's a pretty astounding website with a lot of really great information, and all surrounding your music and how that.
Thank you.
I loved it. And when I did my stalking on Instagram, you know, I listened to a couple of your most recent things, and I told you coming on, like, I've only cried on one podcast, but this might be number two. So, people can find you there, and there's so much there, and it's incredible. I want to just jump into your story.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Tell me about growing up. Tell me about the story before the story.
I was always playing music, since around age 11, I guess, is when I started piano, and then soon after picked up the guitar, and soon after that started playing in a garage band with some boys in my circle of friends, and it was a true garage band. We rehearsed in my friend Walker's garage, cinder block garage, every weekend for hours on end, just sitting around learning tunes and playing. And I always had a guitar in my hand. I was also a very serious athlete. So even when I was, later when I went to college, I played 2 Division I sports, but I would be, when we were traveling as a team, I would always be the one with my guitar and playing and busking in the airports when we were sitting around waiting for our flight to go to and from games and stuff like that. So, you know, music's always been a part of my life. I think I started taking it more seriously around like age 18, 19, 20, kind of, you know, just wanted to spend more time on it. And so I did that and, you know, kind of have been doing that ever since.
Yeah,
and I've always written songs too. I mean, my little garage band, we wrote songs too. And so the songwriting thing started back then as well.
That's a real, you can write books or blogs, but songwriting is a very unique skill. So I find that super impressive that you were doing that and that, and you even said something on the website about like the Tina Turner, and people can read this, but the Tina Turner booklet that you got and how it talked about the program, right?
Yeah.
And how it talked about the songwriters and that it clicked in your head, like you were young, you were 10-ish or younger,
mm-hmm.
and how it clicked in your head that there were people in the background writing for her, which it's crazy that you made that connection. And then you thought, well, I could do that. But then you did.
Yeah.
But then,
You know, we started writing songs it helps to co-write. It's like easier. I mean, now I do all sorts of songwriting by myself. The record Bright Nowhere, although I wrote all those songs myself, with no co-writers. I also write with other co-writers, with other writers. But if you're going to start songwriting out of the blue, it's easier to write with other people because, you know, two brains are better than one and twice the amount of ideas. And so, you know, we wrote songs as kids because kids don't care. They don't care if they rhyme June, Moon, Spoon, you know, like, they think that's a great rhyme. And in certain contexts, that can be a great rhyme. It's not kind of the rhyme I make now, but so, you know, I never really thought about it. I mean, it was only later in life that songwriting became hard, you know?
I think that's a thing for me, though. Like, it's easy for a kid to jump in. Kids don't have all those social norms and ridiculous barriers we put on ourselves. It was continuing it on.
Yeah.
Past that point, that's when where you realize, oh, the writing actually has to be good. The story has to be shared in a way that it connects with other people. I mean, it's like just a few minutes of writing, and it has to be it has to check these certain boxes that normal traditional writing doesn't. And so I think that's an incredible skill. I'm just kind of proud of you. So I'm
thanks.
You know, I mean, like, it's a big deal, but that's a great thing to know that doing it with somebody helps. So if anyone is interested in doing that, sharing their story through that type of writing, that's
sure.
an awesome suggestion.
Yeah, co-writing is so much easier. And nowadays, people co-write with 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, you go look at some credits on some rap songs and hip-hop songs. There's, you know, 10 or 12 people in the room.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But that's so, you know, there's lots of ways to skin a cat. And if you're having trouble, you know, getting started on your own or being motivated, then finding a co-writer or two is really... It also keeps you honest, right? Like, if I made an appointment with you to do this podcast today, like, I'm not going to miss that appointment,
right?
You know, and I have a appointment in my calendar for Friday night with my co-writer. I'm not going to miss that appointment. I mean, unless, you know, all hell breaks loose or something. So it's
right.
It's kind of a built-in accountability feature.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. So you're doing your stuff. You hit that 18 or 19 when it becomes like more important to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the guitar because it's portable. And you already talked about that. I did the same piano lessons with the same woman. I swear we were like, we had back-to-back appointments, you and I, because I had the same, very similar experience. But what I didn't like about the piano is that you couldn't really easily take it with you. So you went guitar and took it everywhere, which was awesome. And then you got more serious. Was that before Berkeley?
Yeah. So okay. I was playing 2 Division I sports, women's ice hockey and women's lacrosse at Harvard, and studying
literature. That's awesome.
And studying English literature. And then, you know, essentially I had an epiphany. I was like, well, I had a question popped into my head one day when I was walking down to the rink. I was like, how many hours a day do I spend doing my sport or anything related to my sport? And when you're playing at that level, it's you know, 5 to 6 hours a day, in addition to your homework and sleeping and, you know, going to class, because it's just that serious. And I was like, wow, I never wanted to be a coach. That wasn't in my, an athletic coach. That wasn't in my cards. I knew that. And at the time I couldn't pursue my career as an Olympian because there was no women's ice hockey. And in the Olympics there is now. And I know a lot of my teammates became Olympians. And there was at the time no women's lacrosse. So that wasn't a possibility. So I was like, well, I love music and I never feel like I'm doing as much of it as I want to. So what would it be like if I even put like 2 or 3 hours a day towards music? Like, what would be possible? Because I know what's possible if you put 6 hours or more every day into your sport, you play at a high level, like I was, you know? So I just, that's pretty much when I decided to drop out of Harvard and go to Berklee College of Music.
Which sounds, I mean, two really, really great colleges. So not putting Berklee down, but like that's a big change.
Well, I mean, it was pretty easy because I went to Harvard and said, I'd like to be studying more electric guitar. I mean, in addition to English literature, and Harvard didn't have a way to help me with that. And at the time they did not have a dual degree with Berklee. They do now, but they didn't then. So I said, well, okay, then I'm going to go to Berklee and pursue a degree over there. And so that's what I did. So the decision was pretty easy because Harvard was pretty much like, no, we're not going to give you any credit for that. And we can't help you. And I was like, okay, well then I'm going to go across the river and study over there.
Right. So great decision, not a hard decision. Once you made that switch, it was pretty cut and dry. Mm-hmm. And then what?
Well, then I got my ass kicked at Berklee College of Music because I had been spending all my life putting my time and effort into athletics and English literature and grades. And all those people had been probably doing the grades thing, but they'd all been putting all their time into their instruments, obviously, or they wouldn't be there. And the gap between how I could play when I arrived at campus for my first day of summer school, because I started in the summer. I had an exam at Harvard the same day I started my classes at Berklee. I was like, oh, I'm screwed. Like, I don't know any, I'm drowning, like, immediately. And so thus ensued, like, just... I mean, the good news is I knew how to work. I knew how to work hard.
Yep.
So I practiced a lot, like a real lot.
So that,
like, I was the first person in the practice rooms when they opened and the last person to leave at night. And I practiced 10 hours a day on a stopwatch in addition to my going to class and my doing my homework. Because, I mean, the regret is that I didn't sleep that much. So consequently, I don't remember a lot of that part of my life, but you know, I just worked hard and I tried to keep my head above water.
At what point did you start to see a shift? Cause that's a lot of work. And you did have the work ethic. You're right. Athletics. Mm-hmm. I mean, studying, yes, but also athletics. Definitely when you're playing a high level at athletics, you're not lacking in work ethic.
Yeah.
So when did you start to see a switch? And you stuck with it too, which, how great is that?
Yeah, I was pretty rough. I mean, it wasn't all roses all the time. I mean, there were plenty of times where I thought, like, wow, I don't, you know, I'm so bad compared to these people and compared to the gap between how I want to play and how I currently can play is so great. It's still so great. I mean, that's you know, I'm interested in mastery. And if you're interested in mastery, you better always have a gap between what you're interested in and where you are. You know, it's an asymptote. Your relationship to mastery, I hope, is always asymptotic, if that's a word, or it's like an asymptote, right? It's always approaching the line, but never touching the line. I don't know. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say I ever reached the point. I got through it. You know, I learned a lot. I studied with some amazing teachers there. I obviously progressed really far on my instrument and my musicianship and my everything to do with music. But it was and continues to be a struggle always. I mean, I'm trying to, you know, master an instrument. It's the infinite game.
Yeah. Isn't that kind of exciting though?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Because it's not like you check the box and then you're bored because it's constant. What was it like with your family? How supportive were they or not supportive? I mean, you're making these. Okay, go ahead.
My parents were obviously not too excited to hear that I wanted to drop out of Harvard. I didn't tell them any of this. I sort of just announced it to them, like, so I've gone across the river and checked out Berklee College of Music, and I'd like to take a few years off, at least a year off from Harvard, and go over there and study. And, you know, they weren't too pleased about that. But my parents were amazing people. And after they spent a couple days getting used to the idea that it might not look like it, they thought it was going to look, they were supportive.
Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm very lucky in that regard. I know that a lot of that's a rarity, and I've always given them full credit for that, you know, for having the faith. And I said to them, look, I'm obsessed by writing and literature and poetry and, you know, reading and learning how to write a great essay or a great piece of writing. Like, I'll be back to Harvard. Like, don't worry. Like, I'm going to finish, but it's just not going to look like you thought it's going to look, or I thought it was going to look.
True. Well, you know, my personal opinion is that college students, you go into college thinking that you know everything, your parents are kind of dumb, nobody, like, you've got all the answers, and then you go there and you're like, holy cow, do not have any answers, have no idea, and I'm going to change my major that I knew was the exact right thing forever. Mm-hmm. I'm going to change that 10 times, and I don't think that that's uncommon. That's a great period of time for that change in learning who you are. So I love that. Did you get back to Harvard and finish?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yay.
I graduated in 1999, and then I continued back at Berklee. I never finished at Berklee. I mean, I don't have a piece of paper from Berklee. Let's put it that way. Okay. I have eight or nine semesters of classes, but I don't have a piece of paper, which is fine with me.
Yeah, no kidding. How excellent, it's just outstanding. Okay, so you have supportive parents, even though you announced after the fact, but that's great that you had that. I mean, lots of people are lacking in that. And then keep going on this journey of yours.
Yeah, so after finishing Harvard and spending a bunch of more semesters at Berklee, I was sort of, so I graduated from Harvard and I just stayed in Boston. So I could continue taking classes at Berklee, and I started writing more songs and recording them and going on the road and making records with a really close friend of mine from Berklee. And that's what I've been doing ever since. I mean, you know, I moved to Canada in there and lived in Canada for about 8 years, from 2004 roughly to 2010. And so I was doing music up there, and that was really amazing, getting to know the incredible Canadian music scene and so many amazing connections. And that was amazing. And then in 2010, I moved back to the States and was moved to New York City, which had been sort of a dream of mine. And was here living and just getting my feet, you know, established in the scene and getting my boots on the ground around here as a player and a songwriter and a producer. And in 2011, my mom got diagnosed with ovarian cancer, stage 3C, a rare and aggressive form. So I moved home to Pennsylvania and moved into a childhood bedroom and decided to take care of her.
And your dad was there and part of this also?
Yeah, my dad, totally. My dad is an amazing wingman, but he's an old school dad. I mean, he was not going to be the one to make tough decisions about treatment. And he wasn't going to be the one to, you know, maximize her nutrition. And that was not in his wheelhouse.
Right.
And I have two older brothers as well. So, you know, they didn't make this decision. I did. I made the decision. And it wasn't even a decision. It was when I heard my mom, you know, had been feeling this way, and she got a CAT scan and the CAT scan results came back. I knew instantly. I mean, it was a watershed moment. Life was going one way or this way. And it went, you know, It was either I'm staying in New York, I'm doing my life, or I'm totally upending my life and going home and walking her from diagnosis to death, because it was a death sentence, essentially.
Right. And you didn't even question it at all.
No.
Which, I mean, what a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Now, interrupting that life, things were going well, and interrupting that life, and it's not about the value of your mom, but how hard was it to interrupt your life? And how much did you stop?
I stopped everything. I mean, I didn't pick up my guitar for a year and a half until she went into her first remission. I think if you asked any of my friends or my peers, it was essentially like I disappeared for 5 years. I mean, we didn't know it would be 5 years. You know, we have the gift of retrospect right now of hindsight. But at the time, it was as if I disappeared. I mean, her care was, she needed to be operated on immediately. She needed to start frontline chemo immediately. Her entire life, her everything, my family's life totally changed. And so there was no part of my life, my old life, that was the same as what happened once I decided to move home and take care of my mom.
But you didn't even pick up the guitar. I mean, you like stopped. And in my
mind, there wasn't time.
Okay.
There wasn't time.
So that was kind of my question, because I guess the question would be like, why was it an all or nothing thing? And that was because of the time that your mom needed.
Yeah. I'm sure other people would have done it differently, but I did it the way I had to do it, which was, there wasn't, I was lucky if I got, an hour in the beginning of the day to myself. And then that hour I was working out, because how I personally process a lot of my life and my world and my stress, and what makes me, one of the things that makes me feel whole is exercise. So, it was the choice between sitting down and practicing my guitar or going to exercise, because the rest of the day was filled up with 5 hours at a chemo suite while she was getting her chemo, fixing her 3 meals because she needed to eat. I needed to get her fed. And the one I put down in front of her made her throw up because the chemo meds, So, okay, it's not that one. It's another one. Okay, it's not that one. It's another one. Or, decisions about her will or, her estate or this, that, or the other thing. I mean, if one is not careful, one can look back on that time and say, well, just why wasn't there time?
Yeah.
But that way lies madness and self-punishment and a revising of history that was not possible at that time. There was no time for me in the way I saw the world.
Correct.
For me to create music. Now, the one thing I did was write ideas down.
Oh, okay.
Things I was noticing, of songs, of ideas, of like, oh, well, if I ever have time ever again, if I ever make it back to music, I'll write a song about this.
Awesome.
And so that's what I did. And so that was what became eventually the 17 songs I wrote for Bright Nowhere.
Right. Okay. So I love that connection, because it was such a huge shift. And I get that was a top priority. That's not a question. And I understand not having time and needing to let go of it. The writing of the ideas, though, those little snippets, how awesome and beautiful was that? Just almost also like a bullet point list of what was happening, because in those situations, it's really difficult to go back and disseminate them enough so that you can come up with the ideas, or like putting things in the right order. I don't know how it would even be possible, because you're so present in the situation, and like you're doing the exercise, you're not swallowed whole, so that you have anything. So I get that you can't do anything, but I love that you wrote those ideas. I love that. So you were writing the ideas and helping your mom, and that was, didn't pick up the guitar for a year and a half, didn't go back into your life for 5 years. And wow. So I want to really share some of that experience with you and your mom, because I shared with you before you went on, like I lost my son at 23. And
I'm so sorry.
Grief and loss is hard. It's hard. And you had a gift of time within that grief. Can you jump into that 5 years until, because the sadness, the grief is that she passed. The gift is that you had that time with her. Tell me about that time with her, what was most important, what you learned, and how, because that is such a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's partly why, that explains why I went in so deep. I mean, I wanted to, I understood the gift that that time was. I was very clear about that. And when my mom got diagnosed, I mean, the second she had the operation, they did the biopsy on her tumor, and the doctor came in and said, you know, I'm sorry to say that you didn't get garden variety cancer, ovarian cancer. You got like carcinosarcoma, the kind that we don't even study, basically, because it's so rare and aggressive. And I looked at my mom, I was standing in the room with her, and I said, after he left, and I said, we are not going to mince words. Like, this thing is going to kill you, whether it kills you tomorrow or five weeks from now or 5 months from now or 5 years from now, you know, this is the thing that's going to kill you. So every minute, you know, so how do you want to live? And I was very, very clear with her and with myself about that. And very clear that any minute we had was a gift, a true gift. And so that became my mission, was to, you know, have her understand on a deep level how precious this was, this time. And so that, you know, obviously that kind of sounds weird, like, well, she would know, she's the one who's dying, but it would have been, it's very easy for a person in her situation. My observation is that, you know, to like, why me?
Yep.
Or to get into a situation like my mom did, where my mom is used to being the person who takes care of everyone.
Yep.
And so all of a sudden she needs to be taken care of. And that's really hard for her to accept and really hard for her to process and really hard for her to not feel like a burden, because my mom and I were close. She knew what I was giving up to be there for her. She knew that my life went from, you know, one didn't look at all like it used to look. And so if I wasn't careful about keeping her focused on, you know, how do you want to live, full out, full on, you know, she would get mired in the, I'm such a burden. How, not so much, why did this happen to me? My mom wasn't like that at all, but like, I just don't want to be a burden.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine that. I would probably feel that. Well, I can see that being a default feeling if it were me with my kids. Mm-hmm. Not the why me. I don't think I would feel that either. Although I can see how a lot of people would feel that way, but more for sure. And also knowing that it's a death sentence and not knowing that it was going to be 5 years, having no idea what that time, even if they give you a timeline, you still don't know for sure if that's going to be the timeline. And how do you take whatever time you have left and make it the best quality for you and everyone else involved? Mm-hmm. So, wow, kudos for recognizing that and stating that and staying on track with that, because that's really, really important.
Yeah.
Really important.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And it ended up being 5 years. Did she want to do everything she could aggressively to fight it?
Yeah. I mean, within reason. Within reason. I mean, we did the dog and pony show at a couple of different, you know, medical centers. You know, we weren't going to do some kind of crazy thing like fly to MD Anderson or anything like that. That wasn't in the cards for us. And we decided in the end that we weren't even going to do, you know, an hour and a half drive to Johns Hopkins or to UPenn. We just stayed with the hospital that she actually was on the board and the fundraising, did a lot of fundraising for, and you know, use their doctors and their oncology center. And so, yes, we fought it as aggressively as we could within reason, because that's right. The other thing is, like, you know, I mean, for the example I use for that is that we went really early into hospice because we knew that, you know, it's about quality of life. It's not about, like, being survived, staying alive for the longest period of time ever.
Well, that's a big decision, right? Because I think, again, like a default is to try to extend things as long as you can, but at what cost?
Yeah. So, yeah, well, I wasn't going to let that happen because I had thought about all that and, you know, had just at that time, we had sort of as a culture, you know, we're by no means anywhere near where we need to be as a culture around the topics of the comfortableness of dying and the death process and grief and loss. We have a long way to go, but I'm talking about 2011. Like, yeah. There was no such thing as death over dinner. There was no such thing as the dinner party. There was no such thing as a book called, you know, Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Like, if there was, I think that book had just come out. And so I had read that book and was like, oh, we're not doing all of this. We're not maximizing lifespan. We're maximizing quality of life. That's what we're maximizing.
I mean, I love that. Those are super, super tough decisions that you have to make in this situation. Or if you don't, I just feel like chaos ensues. I remember my great grandmother going into like assisted living when she got older, and she fought it tooth and nail and losing her license. It was such an example of what I don't ever want to do, because I saw my grandmother and my mom and her siblings really struggling with that. And because of that, my grandmother, she's like, yeah, I'm in my 70s, but I don't want to mow my lawn anymore. So I'm going to be the youngest one in assisted living. And I'm going to have like the most kick-ass time in there for the rest of my life. And no one's ever going to have to worry about this stuff. And that was such a stark difference that makes me realize that there are going to be super tough decisions that you have to make and stick to for everyone's best interest. It's not the person going through it. So, I mean, I love picking your brain about how you processed it, because these are all decisions you had to make that other people might need to make or are in the process of, and they're hard.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they require stillness and fearlessness, a certain fearlessness, you know, to say, like, truly asking, like, how do I want to live? You know, how do I want to die? Yeah. And really, I mean, my whole thing is that how you know, when you start to engage with those kinds of questions, like, how do I want to die? Like, what do I want it to look like? Then you automatically have to answer the question of how I want to live.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not such a dark question. It only seems dark.
And even just talking about like having a will, or someone with a power of attorney. You know, I have that conversation with my kids who are young, although like you never know, but it is about how do you want to live your life so that when this happens, which is inevitable at some unforeseen point in the future, that experience aligns with how you want to live. So yeah, I love that. You picked up your guitar a year and a half in of that 5 years. So what was that like coming back after? I know you're alone and you're not in New York with your people. You're still at home with your mom doing that. What was that transition like? Was it like coming home? Was it a missing?
No, not at all. It was not like coming home.
Tell me.
No. People always say like, oh, was it so healing? It's like, no, it was not healing. It's really difficult to write songs about grief and death and loss and not have them sound cheesy or, syrupy or saccharine or really true to the lived experience that my mom was having and that I was having and that I believe or project that the family was having. So no, it wasn't easy. It wasn't hard. I mean, it wasn't easy. It wasn't healing. But it was necessary. You know, like I had some things I wanted to say and I felt like I was the only way I knew how to say them, or let's say it this way, the best way I knew how to really get at what I was trying to say was through song, through the combination of lyric and music.
So you did it anyway.
Yeah.
100%. Did your mom help write anything or help go through any of that? No.
No, my mom didn't know I was. So my mom went into remission, and I got given awarded a artist residency at a place called the UCross Foundation, which is an artist residency program in northern Wyoming, which takes 9 artists at a time, and you're given room and board private, the musicians are especially are given private houses with a grand piano in them, and you're given and all that's required of you is nothing's required of you. You just have that time and that space, and nobody can disturb you unless the building's burning down, and it's for you to create. And so I was so incredibly lucky to have been awarded a residency at the sort of in the time period when my mom got into remission. So I felt like I could leave. So I left for 6 weeks, and okay. That's when I started writing the songs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense. Wow. Yeah. That's another gift in and of itself, right? But wow, how hard though. So you were able to immerse yourself for 6 weeks in your own grief, your own loss, your own writing ideas, those bullet points. And so at what point did the difficulty become healing, or did it ever?
I don't know. I don't really ever, in my mind, it's not like this wasn't a healing process for me.
Right.
But I don't tend to see, I don't turn to music for healing. I mean, maybe I do. Maybe I turn to other people's music for healing. I don't know. To me, that's so like, to me, that phrase, like, what does it mean? What does that actually mean? What does it mean to say it's healing? So it wasn't for me a healing process. It was just what I do. I mean, that's just, I'm a songwriter. If there's things I'm curious about or things I'm chewing on intellectually or things I want to understand better, then I'm going to try to write a song about it. Because then I really understand it at a deeper level. It's like if you want to really observe something, try to draw it.
Right.
It's the same analogy. If you really want to observe something, you know, or understand what it really looks like, try to draw it. And you will see like, oh, there's all these things about this thing I'm looking at that I never even saw before, because now I'm having to like recreate it on a page. You know, and so that's my analogy for songwriting. It's like, oh, I wanted to explore. There's a song on the record called Victory on the Road to Defeat.
Okay.
Because I was really, because what annoyed the fuck out of me was when my mom was, you know, frontline chemo worked, second line chemo worked. Pretty much that was it. Nothing else worked after that. And they were like still offering her medicine. And I was like, guys, nothing's working. Like, stop offering solutions. It's time to go home with hospice care. Like, it's not time for another drug or another appointment or another, you know, this, that. And that's just the Western medicine system, right? Like, we could go down a giant rabbit hole about why that is. And everybody means well, but like, you know, et cetera. I'm not going to, well, that's not the course, dead horse we're going to beat right now. But so I wanted to write a song that really captured that feeling of like, are you fucking kidding me? Mm-hmm. You're sitting here offering us solutions when like, you know, you're offering a victory when it's actually, we're on the road to defeat. Like, no, we're out of here. We're going home. We're getting hospice and we're living, you know, the best we can until the end. And how do you write that song? Like, is that even a song that can be written, right?
Right.
That's the challenge to myself.
Got it.
Can I even write that song? All right, I'm gonna take that challenge. Can I write that song in a way that's not bad? Like, it's just not a bad song. Can I write that way in a way that, like, you know, actually gets to the crux of that terrible paradox? You know? And so for me, it's more like, I mean, if you want to say it's healing, that's a way to say it. But for me, it's more like an intellectual and a heart and a soul challenge to wrestle with these ideas. And it doesn't even have to be this record. I mean, all the songs that I've written in my life to some degree, except for the ones I wrote when I was 11 and 12 and 13.
Those are probably the best. Come on.
I mean, I'm sure I was wrestling with things too there, but right, you know, they were the things that a teenager wrestles with. But like, you know, all the songs that I write now are more like, I need to get, there's a crux, there's something there that I need to, there's a knot I need to untie.
Wow, that's a great way to put it. I think for me, writing's a cathartic way to process. Mm. It's like drawing that drawing, right? Like you, because things will come up. Actually, it happens to me a lot when I'm running, and you mentioned exercise before. Mm-hmm. The way my thoughts, okay. So like all of a sudden you're like, no, I'm not angry. No, I'm fine. And you start running and like 20 minutes later, you want to beat someone, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of cathartic processing of ideas or information or situations that I love. And I think over time, maybe that's healing. It's definitely a way to look at it and process it for me. Mm-hmm. So the other thing in your music, how do you do that? Like you said, not in a saccharine or super sweet or like skipping and rainbows, but also not in a deep, dark, depressive, like where's that balance? Cause you're talking about heavy, hard topics. And
yeah. Well, I mean, I was very cognizant that once I had written more than one or two or three songs, and I knew, okay. The first challenge was, can you even write about this without it being
correct?
Either totally maudlin and melancholy or, you know, totally saccharine sweet. So once I could do that, once I wrote, the first song I wrote was the song Death Comes Slow. And then I wrote a few more right after that. And I was like, okay, I can do this. Like, it's not easy, but I can do it. Then it became, okay, I could probably write an album's worth, because I definitely have an album's worth of ideas I want to chew on. Mm-hmm. Then it became like, I have a message and a mission here with this music, which is to like open up a conversation around death and dying and grief and loss. And the only way it's actually going to get through is if it's not presented totally, you know, in a dim, dark way.
Yeah.
Like it's almost got to be a Trojan horse. Mm. So the song Fight the Good Fight, or the song Nothing I Won't Bear, or the song Roll the Stone Back. Like if you heard those are songs on the record, you could go and listen to them. And if you didn't know what I was writing about, you might think I was writing about like love or, you know, like, I mean, it's all about love. Like,
right.
The songs are about love, but you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that I was writing about this topic. And right. So it was really important to me to write songs that were positive up-tempo. Mm-hmm. Even though they were about grief and loss.
Right.
And then it was also really important to me to find the sounds that would be the Trojan horse, you know? So that's hence the giant production, and why the record sounds so amazing, is because I was hell bent on making it sound that way, because I knew if I just did, you know, solo guitar and voice, like everybody I knew was saying to me like, oh, this music is so personal. You should definitely it should just be guitar and voice. I mean, it's so powerful in that way. And I'm like, yes, of course it is. Like by that point, my mom had died and I was playing this music live and trying to figure out how you play it live without leaving everybody in a total puddle, including yourself.
Right.
You know, and everyone was like, no, you should just do it like that. And I was like, okay, yeah, maybe one day I'll just do it like that. I'll make a record that's just like solo guitar and voice of these songs. And I'm also going to make a huge record where these songs are like Trojan horses, basically.
Yeah.
So
I want to kind of wrap up by talking about having you discuss you navigated your mom's death and then you got back into music and what that was like, and kind of leave us with, I guess, your words of advice for people that are travel, like it doesn't have to be this particular struggle, but struggles that are really life consuming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Know? Well, yeah, the loss doesn't have to mean death, you know, loss
correct.
Can be the loss of a job. It can be the loss of a pet. It can be, you know, the loss of a dream you had.
Yeah.
Loss of a, you know, place. what's my bon mot that I leave for people? What was your question?
Well, what helped you the most? So I'd love to learn about your mom's passing briefly, mm-hmm. and then navigating from that back into music, which you've touched on a little bit. What were the things that helped you transition back into your life? Mm-hmm. 'Cause it was 5 years.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, my mom died. It turned out she lived basically 4.5 years, which was amazing. The doctors, you know, in the beginning said maybe she'd be lucky if she got 2. And those 4.5 years were really high quality years. And obviously, as I mentioned before, she went into hospice quite early, which was amazing. And hospice is incredible. And I just can't say enough about hospice. I think there should be hospice for the living, not only for the dying, because it's such an incredible organization. So I stuck around at home after my mom died and did the memorial service for her. And just because my dad needed help, like, you know, righting the ship and getting the ship sailing in the right direction. So I stuck around for about 6 months helping with that. I didn't feel like I could just be like, okay, see ya. And, you know, obviously some of that too was my own sense of needing to process it. But then I, you know, thankfully for me, you know, luckily for me, I had the songs. Like, I was like, okay, now I know what the next chunk of my life is going to be about. It's going to be about writing these songs. So, you know, that's what I basically set out to do then. And then I had a number of other artist residencies, both at UCross and at other places around the country and the world, to finish writing those songs. I did a lot of the writing in this room here, you know, and then eventually went to find the producer, because even though I produced my own records in the past and other people's records, I knew I didn't want to produce this record. I didn't want to wear that hat. So I went to find my producer, and luckily I found Rob Mounsey, who's just an unbelievable producer and like a dream. And if you check out his discography and what he's produced and what he's played on, and you will be agog. You know, and then he and I basically set about recording the record. So that was kind of like, I knew what was in front of me, you know, and then things yep. happened, like the TED Talk opportunity. The TEDx talk got dropped in my lap. Like mm-hmm. somebody had seen a video of me talking like this mm-hmm. and was like, wow, I run this TEDx event. Would you come and, you know, speak about it? So then that took up a bunch of my time to create that talk and, you know, just like that.
I love that you kind of saw the vision in front of you and knew what parts of it you wanted to do and what mm-hmm. parts you wanted to allocate. I think that's a super important thing that we forget about, like let other people live in their zone of genius and
totally
take over those parts. Mm-hmm. And also you were really very aware of opportunities that presented themselves and utilizing those.
Yeah.
And those are two things that sometimes people overlook. So, Kate, I have loved our conversation and we could keep it going. However, we can't do that today. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing this story and lots of tools for people in their loss. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And really, you know, I'm sorry for the loss of your son. And that is a particular loss I don't know anything about, and I can't imagine, but I'm so sorry for you. And
well, thank you. I mean, loss, we all go through different losses, we just talked about that, so it's a matter of navigating it to the best of our ability.
Thank you for having me and for giving me the opportunity to talk about the music. And you know, I hope people take the opportunity to listen to it. You can hear it everywhere. A lot of it's on my website, but it's also on Spotify and mm-hmm. Apple Music.
Oh yes, I'm glad you said that. I'll find it on Spotify. Okay.
Yeah, it's awesome. On all those places, and a lot of it's also on YouTube. And you know, and if people want to find me, they can. My handle is just at Kate Shutt on all the social media platforms. So I'm easy to find, and I have a great newsletter that if people are interested,
yes.
You know, I put out every couple of weeks, and it's not, you know, it's more like cool music ideas and cool book recommendations and interesting takes on the world. So if people were like this conversation, and it's not all about death and dying, it's mostly about life and living.
Good. All right.
So they can sign up for that on my website.
Awesome. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Which go do. So yeah. Already done. Good. Mm-hmm. Good job. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
The podcast was designed to create a worldwide epidemic of healing, gratitude, and joy. Thank you for investing your time with me. It would be amazing if you would share this episode with someone who could benefit from it. Reach out to me on any platform. You are worth it to me. Remember to subscribe, like, leave a review, and connect with me. Until next time.